Call to order the House Committee on Environment and Water and open a public hearing on House Bill 2186. Members and audience, we are going to begin with this public hearing. We are also posted for a work session on House Bills 2231 and 2232. We will not be working House Bill 2232, but we do need to reserve some portion of today's meeting for discussion and possible motion on House Bill 2231. So this is partly to alert the folks that are here for House Bill 2186 that we will be wrapping that portion up, trying to wrap that up by a quarter to five. There are a number of folks signed up to testify. I'll ask you to try to keep your comments brief, and as I get a better sense of who's here, I will perhaps be suggesting and enforcing some time limits on testimony. We will begin with 2186, and if I could have Dave Vantoff and Annie Ginsberg join us to provide an overview of the bill. That's your pleasure. And you will notice, members who are here, only 3:03. We are beginning close to on time, and I appreciate the attendance of those folks who made it in the door by 3:01 or 3:02.
I apologize, Mr. Chair, for not being here on time.
Thank you.
I appreciate the need of a committee to operate in a timely fashion.
We have a very full agenda. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Cannon, members of the committee. My name is Dave Vantoff, and I'm the Governor's Sustainability Policy Advisor, for the record. Thanks for the opportunity to briefly testify on this bill today. Andy is going to walk through the bill in much more detail, but I wanted to just very briefly provide some context for the bill. First, I want to remind you all that this is one of several bills that the Governor introduced this session as a comprehensive approach to combat global warming and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I shared with this committee last week a summary of the complete package of bills, so I won't take up more of your time reiterating any of that testimony. But just to note that in the Governor's view, this bill plays an important role along with the others in helping Oregon to achieve its statutory greenhouse gas reduction goals. Some of the authority that would be created under this bill, such as that concerning low-resistance tires, was identified as early as 2004 by the Governor's Global Warming Advisory Group as low-hanging fruit to benefit consumers by saving money on gasoline while also reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Others, like providing authority to develop a low-carbon fuel standard, would create the opportunity for Oregon to participate with California, British Columbia, and Washington in creating a common fuel standard for the West Coast. And again, at the same time, further Oregon's existing transportation fuel policies to reduce our reliance on foreign sources of oil, keep more of our transportation dollars in Oregon, and reduce the environmental footprint of our transportation system. None of these proposed measures are without opposition from vested interests, and you'll hear today concerns from them. As with the Governor's other climate change bills, the Governor welcomes legislative guidance in modifying and hopefully improving the content of this bill. The Governor's overarching goal, though, is to make as much real and significant steps forward as possible this legislative session to put Oregon on a path to achieve our long-term greenhouse gas reduction goals and to do so in a way that grows our economy at the same time. So thanks for that chance to give real brief introductory remarks, and I'll hand it over to Andy if there's no questions.
Because Mr. Vantoff has to leave, if there are any questions for him, now would be the time to ask them. Seeing none, you're free to go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Andy.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator at DEQ. And with your permission, I'd like to ask Rick Wallace from the Department of Energy to come up and join me. And we have a very brief presentation. I know you're under time constraint, but the purpose of this presentation is to put the House Bill 2186 in context for you. So we're gonna briefly review, look at where greenhouse gas emissions come from and some of the existing things that are being done to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and some of the things that are proposed this session and how this particular bill fits in. This pie chart shows you the emissions from greenhouse gases, and you can see that electricity is the largest slice. But if you look at transportation fuel combined with residential, commercial, and heating fuel, you can see that that accounts for about 39% of our emissions. Industry is a smaller slice, but still important. And the purpose of showing this is to emphasize that good data is really critical in our work to address greenhouse gases. And we're doing a number of things to improve our data. One is greenhouse gas emission reporting, and that will feed into the inventory to help improve that. So what I'd like to just briefly do is go through each slice of the pie and point out some of the things that are being done and that may be done. And if we start with electricity, some of the strategies for reducing greenhouse gases from electricity would be increasing the mix of power that comes from low-carbon fuels. The renewable portfolio standard is one way to get at that. Incentives for renewables are another. We also can look at ensuring that new power plants that are built are efficient and meet certain performance standards to have low greenhouse gas emissions. We can also look at using electricity more efficiently. The tax credits and grants for residential and business efficiency measures, building performance standards that you're considering this session, as well as appliance efficiency standards. And then in the future, we may have other things that we can look at, such as carbon sequestration or treatment to actually control the greenhouse gas emissions. That's not available today. So some of the key legislation being considered this session will conserve energy and provide lower carbon new power. Then moving on to heating fuels. In this case, we have options of using lower carbon fuels, and obviously incentives for renewable fuels would fit into that. Conserving fuel, that would be tax credits and grants for weatherization and more efficient appliances and heaters, building efficiency standards so we use the fuel more efficiently. And some of the key legislation that you're considering this session would help conserve energy and support renewable energy projects. And then moving on to transportation fuels, the strategies would be first to reduce the emissions from vehicles, and we've already adopted a clean tailpipe standards for new motor vehicles. We also have incentives for hybrid vehicles. And then another strategy would be to use lower carbon fuels. So we've got renewable fuel standards that were adopted last session, and as part of House Bill 2186, we'll be considering a low carbon fuel standard, which I'll go into further a little later. Another strategy is to reduce miles driven, and that's where Oregon's land use and transportation planning system comes into play, as well as transit and other travel options. So some of the key legislation that you're considering this session includes the low carbon fuel standards, improving fuel efficiency of existing vehicles, and also looking at evaluating the greenhouse gas emissions during transportation planning. Moving on to the industry slice of the pie, then we have options to look at energy conservation and manufacturing, and then potential future strategies for using lower carbon fuels, using lower emitting processes, or producing products with less waste that are more reusable. There aren't any measures like that currently in effect, although many companies are pursuing them on their own. Some key legislation being considered this session would expand the business energy tax credit to 50% for industrial-scale energy efficiency projects that could help in this area. Moving on to the waste sector. Here, some of the things that can be done are waste prevention and recycling. If we reduce the amount of material going to landfills, we also reduce those materials being transported, so you can reduce transportation emissions and also manufacturing emissions. So it's a waste prevention and recycling is a key greenhouse gas strategy across the board. Methane capture is also another strategy. We currently have some landfill closure requirements, and if methane is much more efficient at trapping heat than carbon dioxide, so venting methane from landfills is a pretty significant source of greenhouse gas emissions. And some of the key legislation that you're considering this session would, as part of House Bill 2186, would look at reducing the wasteful use of certain high global warming potential gases, and I'll go into that later. And then finally, just to mention agriculture, Some of the strategies for reducing greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture would be energy conservation and best management practices. There aren't any existing or proposed regulations with regard to agriculture, but many of the strategies that you're considering will actually create demand for biofuels created from agricultural products, so there's potential benefit for agriculture from some of the greenhouse gas work. And so that concludes my brief overview of the pie chart. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and Rick would as well, and then we'll go right into a brief overview of the bill.
Thanks. Are there any questions at this point on the overview before we get to the specifics of House Bill 2186? Seeing none, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, again for the record, Andy Ginsberg, Air Quality Administrator with DEQ. And I'm here to provide some information and urge your support for House Bill 2186 to help us achieve our greenhouse gas goals. The bill would authorize the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt targeted measures that would reduce greenhouse gas emissions from transportation fuel, from vehicles, and from certain greenhouse gas-emitting products. It requires the Environmental Quality Commission to consider safety, feasibility, and cost-effective and any rules that are adopted under the statute. Many of the measures that we would be looking at under the statute, in addition to reducing greenhouse gases, would also have other benefits for public health, and that, for example, would be reducing toxic diesel emissions. And also some of these strategies would have economic benefits, for example, energy conservation, saving energy, and supporting the development of biofuels facilities in Oregon. So I'll just briefly walk through the sections of the bill. Section 31A addresses a low-carbon fuel standard. Transportation currently accounts for about one-third of our greenhouse gas emissions, so it's a sector that we need to address to achieve our goals. In 2007, you adopted a renewable fuel standard, which was an important step in reducing greenhouse gases from transportation fuel. But House Bill 2186 would take the next step by establishing a low-carbon fuel standard as a complement to the renewable fuel standard. The standard would increase the use of low-carbon fuels. That would include biofuels such as ethanol and biodiesel, but it would also include other fuels such as hydrogen, electricity, compressed natural gas, and biogas. And we look at the carbon emissions per unit of energy throughout the life cycle of the fuel. So you're considering not just the emissions from burning the fuel, but also the emissions from producing the fuel, storing it, and transporting it. A low-carbon fuel standard favors biofuels that would be made, for example, from waste here locally in Oregon over biofuels that, for example, were made in the Midwest from corn because it would have a lower carbon content. California and the Northeast states are all looking at a low-carbon fuel standard. California's planning on having their rule adopted by April. So we would be looking closely at those programs and adopting something that was as similar as possible to minimize any compliance concerns, but tailoring it for Oregon, whatever Oregon's unique specific needs are. And key considerations in developing the standard would be cost, obviously reliable fuel supply, flexible program implementation, and administrative efficiency. Moving on to Section 31B of the bill. This section deals with what are known as high global warming potential gases. Carbon dioxide is the most common greenhouse gas, but these high global warming potential gases, although they're emitted in much lower quantities, have a much greater potential of trapping heat, and so their impact is much greater than the actual tons emitted. The three major types of high global warming potential gases are called hydrofluorocarbons, perfluorocarbons, and sulfur hexafluoride. They're used as refrigerants, propellants, fire suppressants, and solvents, and they're also used in aluminum production, semiconductor manufacture, and they also provide electrical insulation for high voltage systems. Some of these products are up to 20,000 times more potent at trapping heat than carbon dioxide, and also some of them have very long life, are long lived in the atmosphere. They can, some of them can live up to 10,000 years in the atmosphere, which means essentially once they're released, it's irreversible. And so the goal here is to prevent the release in the first place. In many cases, these gases are essential, and they must be used. In other cases, they've been introduced recently to replace other substances that deplete the ozone layer, so they have some benefits. On the other hand, there are cases where the use could be restricted so that we don't have waste. And one example is with auto air conditioners. If you have a leak in your air conditioning system for your car, you can buy a can of a product called HFC-134A, and you can fill your air conditioning system up with that without repairing the leak. And then what will happen is gradually the material will leak out, and then you'll buy another can and fill it up. Well, actually, the correct way to handle that would be to take your car to an auto repair shop where they can remove the greenhouse gases that are currently in the system, store them safely, repair the leak, and then refill the system. So one option that the Environmental Quality Commission could consider under House Bill 2186 would be to ban the retail sale in cans of this substance and only allow it to be used by a qualified auto mechanic.
Andy, I'm going to stop you for just a second. What is it about Section 3.1b that restricts it to the three high global warming potential gases that you've identified in your testimony? As I read the section, it would appear to apply to, well, it just says greenhouse gases, which I assume is a broader category.
Mr. Chair, the primary strategies that would be adopted under that section would deal with high global warming potential gases, but you're absolutely right. It does say greenhouse gases, and there are probably examples, for example, nitrous oxide, which is a greenhouse gas but is not one of the three high global warming potential gases, can be used as a propellant in some of these substances. So it is broader than that. The main examples would focus on high global warming potential gases, and certainly we could look at some amendments to clarify and tighten up that language.
Representative Barker.
Mr. Chair, the bill refers to ORS 468.8.210, which contains the definition of greenhouse gas as any gas that contributes to anthropogenic global warming, including but not limited to carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, hydrofluorocarbons, perfluorocarbons, and sulfur hexafluoride. So it includes the gases he's describing, but it also includes carbon dioxide and methane and any anthropogenic global warming gas.
Yeah, my sense is that this may be something we need to look at, but go ahead. Okay. I don't mean to deter you from your...
Okay, and just to clarify, Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, you're absolutely correct that carbon dioxide could be considered as well, but it would not be carbon dioxide caused by burning a product. It would be carbon dioxide that was contained in a product, like in a can as a propellant. So it's not all types of uses of materials, but specifically substances that are in products. But as we discussed, we can look at some amendments. And just another quick example would be a consumer product like a canned tire inflator or a electronic cleaner or even some of party foam strings and other types of products actually have global warming gases that are used as propellants or solvents. So House Bill 2186 would authorize the Commission to adopt measures to restrict the use of those products, but only where there are safe and effective alternatives and where it's feasible and cost-effective. And those are key factors because in many cases these products, really there are no substitutes, and obviously those wouldn't be affected. Moving on to Section 3.1c. Here we're talking about fuel efficiency for commercial trucks. Freight vehicles account for about 20% of the energy that's used in transportation, and there are many aftermarket devices that can improve the fuel economy of a vehicle and thereby reducing the greenhouse gases, but also saving money over time because of the savings in fuel and reducing toxic diesel emissions. So examples would be fairings and skirts that are used to reduce turbulence. They direct air over and around the truck and along the sides of the truck. There's other examples that could reduce rolling resistance, like single wide tires low rolling resistance tires. So those are two examples. The Federal Environmental Protection Agency has packaged those types of pieces of equipment together with in a program called SmartWay. And SmartWay essentially is a overall program for carriers and shippers that's aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions from transportation. We're fortunate to have in Oregon a company called Cascade Sierra Solutions. You may hear from them today. They're located in Cobourg, and they're one of the SmartWay providers that's featured on EPA's website. They provide equipment and showrooms as well as innovative financing options to help truckers purchase and install this equipment. As I said, the equipment has very short payback. You start saving money immediately in lower fuel costs, but there is an upfront investment, and that's where Cascade Sierra comes in, where they help companies to get loans that can be paid back as they have savings. House Bill 2186 would authorize the commission to establish requirements for commercial trucks that could be met through flexible programs like SmartWay. Moving on to Section 3.1D, here we're talking about low rolling resistance tires that Dave VanHoff mentioned a minute ago. Tires account for about 15 to 25% of the rolling resistance of a car, and auto manufacturers typically use low rolling resistance tires on new cars so that they can get the best possible fuel economy rating when they're testing the cars. But then when your tires wear out and you go to replace the tires, there's no information about the rolling resistance of the tires that you go to buy. They're not labeled, and there are no regulations or requirements or even incentives for manufacturers to provide replacement tires. And those tires can vary by 20 to 30%, even when you're looking within the same class of tire, the same size, the same performance. So they can have quite a variation in rolling resistance. And just to be clear, rolling resistance and grip are not the same thing. Low rolling resistance tires can safely grip the highway. They're designed in particular ways that they can reduce the resistance to motion but still not skid. House Bill 2186 would authorize requirements for replacement tires that would be at least as energy efficient as those tires on new vehicles on average, only to the extent, again, that it's feasible, safe, and cost-effective. And then moving on to Section 3.1E, here we're talking about tire inflation, which is another key factor in reducing rolling resistance. So for each 1 pound per square inch that your tires are underinflated, you'll lose nearly 0.5% in your fuel economy, so it's pretty significant. And the federal government estimates that something like 74% of vehicles have at least one tire that's significantly underinflated. So new vehicles that are sold since 2007 have automatic monitoring of tire pressure, and so there's information provided there. But the problem is for existing vehicles built before then, there's no system in place to periodically or routinely check tire pressure. The best time really to do that is when your car is getting an oil change or when you're in for a tune-up, to have the mechanic just do a quick and simple test to see if your tires are filled, and then fill them up if they're not. And many of them, as you know, do offer that service already as a customer service provision, but not all do. And so House Bill 2186 would authorize the commission to establish a requirement that if your car is in for service for some other reason, that the mechanic check the tire pressure and fill it up. And then finally, Section 3.1F deals with commercial engine idling. Engine idling accounts for a pretty significant use of fuel. It's not uncommon for drivers to idle their engines for 6 to 8 hours every day after a long haul to stay warm or cool in the cab. And, of course, driver comfort is essential to the job. But idling the main engine is not the most efficient way to cool or heat the cab. It creates, as I said, a large waste of fuel, which then generates greenhouse gas emissions as well as diesel emissions, toxic diesel emissions. Not only that, it increases engine maintenance costs. It can shorten the engine life, and the fumes can harm the driver's health, and, of course, the noise is very annoying to neighbors. So there are two main strategies for reducing engine idling. The first is to install plug-in options, and there are two different major manufacturers that produce plug-in alternatives. We have several of them in Oregon. A company called Shore Power Technologies has installations in Klamath Falls, Portland, and Cobourg, and is developing new installations at truck stops in Canyonville and Pendleton. And these are under an Oregon Solutions project. And then there's another company called Idle Air, which has installations in Aurora and Troutdale, and those were also done as part of Oregon Solutions, or inspired by Oregon Solutions. So basically what you do is you, instead of idling your engine, you have an option to bring plug-in power, so you have a heater or an air conditioner that can be brought into the cab with lots of great other amenities, because you can have connection to internet, telephone, movies, and all kinds of things can come with it if you choose. The second option, where we don't have an actual plug-in unit, is to use a small auxiliary power unit. So this is just a small generator that's designed to produce electricity, and it can be carried on the car and used on the truck where there's no hookups available. There are a number of existing incentives to encourage the use of these, the Business Energy Tax Credit, as well as Energy Loan Program, and the Oregon Transportation Infrastructure Bank all provide incentives. Last session, Senate Bill 223 exempted auxiliary power units from the weight limit, so that the weight of the unit itself doesn't count. And then last year, Congress added an exemption from federal excise taxes, so there's some financing available to help. The 15 different states around the country do have idling restrictions, and lots of localities do, including the city of Ashland. EPA has now developed a model rule that they developed after meeting with the industry and discussing the fact that having different idling regulations in each state is creating a problem for the industry. So they're encouraging states to opt into the model rule. They're not planning on adopting a national idling rule, but they would like states to opt into this uniform requirement so that truckers know no matter what state they go into, they have the same requirements. So House Bill 2186 would authorize the Environmental Quality Commission to opt into that model rule. Also, you'll notice in Section 31F, we mentioned ships and ports, and I need to mention that this is an area where idling is also significant, but a lot more complicated to address because of international competition. So because of the nature of our ports and the types of ships that visit our ports, it may or may not be possible to have idling restrictions at ports. And under this bill, the department would work closely with Oregon's ports to see what, if any, control strategies would be cost-effective or possible. With regard to the fiscal impact of the bill, DEQ would implement this bill through a combination of existing and new staff. Many of the strategies, as you heard, also reduce toxic air pollution. They also reduce fine particulate pollution. So some of our existing staff are already working on strategies like this and could be diverted to work on this effort instead. We also, in the governor's recommended budget, we have two new positions to work on this, although they are phased in during the last 6 months of the biennium. So we would have some resource towards the end of the biennium added. And so in conclusion, House Bill 2186 would provide some important new tools for addressing climate change, and we would work closely with stakeholders to develop any regulations under this statute and ensure that they're feasible, cost-effective, and work for Oregon. And as I mentioned, we'll probably have some amendments to bring back to you when you have a work session. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great, and I'm going to go to Representative Gilliam in a moment. I just want to, for the committee's benefit, describe again my plan for today, and it's changed somewhat. We have a number of folks signed up to testify, and I'll be calling them up in panels. My guess is that we're not able to get through them all. We will, if necessary, continue hearing this bill a week from today. We will be going at 4:15. We'll be closing down the public hearing in order to work 2231. Representative Benz has to leave at 4:30, so we'd like to get a vote on that, if possible, before he leaves then, but then we'll reopen for the final half hour, and if I'm wrong about the time and everybody's quick and we manage to zip through all this today, that will be fine, but I do want to assure the committee, as well as folks who are here to testify, that we want to take our time with this, understand the issues involved. It's a short bill, but a big one. And I would encourage you to ask your questions. So with that, Representative Gilliam and then Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Gendrew, thank you for being here on such an important bill. You have a lot to be proud of in your record over there at Oregon DEQ. In fact, my first question, and I'll just have one follow-up after that, Mr. Chair, is how would you characterize the standards that we all enjoy in Oregon, and how what is our rating nationally in that regard? How would you size that up?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, we've made a lot of progress in cleaning the air in Oregon. We used to have quite a few areas were violating federal air quality standards, and over the years, through plans that were developed with local governments and stakeholders, we've managed to attain federal standards. But recently, those standards have tightened, particularly for fine particulate, and so we are now violating the standards in two communities, Klamath Falls and Oak Ridge, and there are three additional communities that are on the cusp of violating as soon as we have 3 years of data, and many others that are approaching the standard. So we have huge challenges in front of us with regard to fine particulate, and I'll just mention, although this bill is not aimed at fine particulate, many of the strategies that would reduce greenhouse gas emissions from diesel engines would also help reduce fine particulate. With regard to air toxics, we have a number of toxic air pollutants that are over health benchmarks, and in particular, benzene, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons and diesel exhaust are our three largest. So, again, this bill would have a secondary benefit of helping with some of those issues.
Well, you're pretty tough on yourself because I agree. You know, you want to address what remains, but what I'm trying to focus in on is where we are. We're among the toughest in the nation. So I appreciate the fact that you want to be even better, but what I'm getting at is the difference. This is the thing that concerns me about the bill, is when we have some of the toughest in the nation, I think, I want to know your thoughts on goals. What is it? Does a goal mean, you know, a reference target, which I think has sort of been what we've gone, everybody got their cell phone now, has been what we've adhered to, versus mandatory standards? And that's my fear in this. Are we moving? What is your definition of goals for this bill? Because what I fear is that what we're not seeing in some of the between the lines is the ability for you all to move possibly to penalties for noncompliance versus other kinds of avenues. What are your thoughts on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, you're correct that if we established regulations under this bill and there are violations, there could well be enforcement. We envision that many of these strategies would be implemented through cooperative educational outreach programs. But, for example, a low-carbon fuel standard will have requirements that have to be met. They're very flexible, by the way. There's provisions for trading and banking, and there are compliance periods and offsets. But if a fuel distributor doesn't comply with the standard, it would be a violation. It could result in a civil penalty. The goal is to make progress towards our greenhouse gas reduction goals that were established by the legislature last session. And one of my goals is to look at things in a more comprehensive fashion rather than having one set of regulations to reduce diesel emissions, another set to try and meet fine particulate standards, and a third set to try and address global warming. If we can find strategies that do all together in the most cost-effective way, we're a lot better off. So that's our hope, is that many of these strategies, because they involve combustion of fossil fuels, that also results in many of our other air pollution issues, we can get some efficiencies.
I know you're going to move on, so it's not a follow-up, but a follow-up comment. I'd say thank you. I appreciate the shared goal of lower gas emissions, but your answer raises more questions for me than it answers, because I think we need a little more definitive answer on what this really means. You gave several sort of a range of things, and I don't think the bill addresses what you mentioned.
Yeah, and I think that's an issue we'll continue to explore today. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Chair. I didn't have my afternoon coffee yet.
For the promotion.
Sorry. We have a set of priorities here, or criteria to consider as we move through these. And number five, fairness. How well does a fee increase relate to ability to pay? That kind of made me think about some of the constituent calls and emails I've been getting today and yesterday on this bill. Andy, I just can't see in anything but the hike here from your trip to Everest. So I had a few questions on, maybe it's just the wording, restrictions and prohibitions and everything like that, and maybe by just tweaking the language of it, it can be more incentivizing than regulating in that sense. And I do understand, and I'm right at the front of the bus for addressing global warming, et cetera. And I appreciate all that you guys are doing to try to do that. But I'm concerned about the constituents I have who live paycheck to paycheck, and in some cases that's an unemployment paycheck in that sense. And I know every time I take my car in to get a tune-up or some work on it, it's several hundred dollars. So the option of them having this one piece addressed of getting their tires inflated properly is probably a moot point. And some of the things, the requirements on the trucks, et cetera, I'm thinking of old stuff, old vehicles. And in my area, there's a lot of them. There's a lot of activity on farms and in the forest where they are going to be idling at points. They're not going to turn the rig on and off and on and off and thinking milk delivery, stuff like that. So there must be some sort of exceptions for some of these other uses, and maybe some sympathy for some of the people who might have a hard time meeting these standards right now. And I heard you say, though, that you're working on incentivizing cooperation with other existing programs, et cetera. I think it's just that the wording, Gilliam mentioned that too, it sounds like it's going to lead to fines, and these people can't afford gas, hardly, let alone fines for not operating correctly. So I think they need a little break. Thank you. I guess I commented on it.
Thanks, Representative Boone. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was tempted, I must say, to comment on Section 3B, but I'll avoid that. And just ask, it seems to me as if each one of your sections under Section 3A, B, C, each one of those could be a separate bill. Each one raises huge issues. And expensive issues, difficult issues. And it seems almost as though we as a legislature would be avoiding the tough job of weighing and balancing the costs that go with this type of a proposal. Perhaps you could just focus on 3A, the low carbon fuel standards, and express to us how much of an impact you think that would have on the people of the state, notwithstanding your efforts in the latter part of the bill to maybe signal a willingness to control those standards.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, maybe Rick can help me with this answer as well, but the low-carbon fuel standard is being first developed by the state of California, and now the Northeast states are looking at it. There are a lot of provisions in that bill that are designed to ensure that you'll have a gradual, over multiple years improvement in the carbon intensity, or lowering of the carbon intensity in the fuel, doing that in a cost-effective way by providing many, many different ways to comply. So there's no mandate that you have to put any specific type of fuel additive or mixture of fuels together, but there are many pathways, including market options for trading among companies and making reductions in 1 year and taking credit for them in another year. So those rules are designed to be flexible, but by their very nature, they would be way too detailed to include in a statute. It's going to be important for us to be able to keep pace as California implements their program and the Northeast states implement their program and revise them to address any issues that come up that we're able to nimbly follow. So the idea here is that we would we'd be authorized to opt into this program, but we would be keeping track with our neighboring state that obviously has a much larger market for gasoline and diesel than we do, and a much larger staff to work with the industry and keep track of changes that need to be made to the program. So that's why we didn't put all the detail in the bill. The idea would be for us to adopt something that was as similar as possible to what California does, although recognizing that there may need to be a few differences for Oregon. I don't know if I fully answered your question.
Hello, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question is, how much of an impact will this particular set of standards have, just the one, just A. And I'm sure you're not suggesting that we connect to California. You're not suggesting that. That we want to make our own rules, our own laws, our own standards. So are you suggesting that we might want to modify this to say pretty close to California but not quite? Is that your thinking?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, we'll be having conversations with the industry to see how much they want to tie it to California. I absolutely agree with you that we need to have our own standards in Oregon that are tailored to Oregon's unique needs. On the other hand, a program that affects the fuel supply, we're going to be in the same market as California, and so in all likelihood, the industry will want us to be similar to California. So we'll work with them and see in what way they would like to reference California. But I absolutely agree with you that we need to have our own standards in Oregon that are unique to Oregon. With regard to impacts, the program is designed so that fuel supply will not be disrupted, and it's designed to be flexible so that we would minimize any cost increase for fuel. I think it would be unreasonable to say that there will be no cost increase. I think reducing carbon content of fuel is going to cost something, but doing it through a program like this, where there are so many flexible market-oriented approaches to compliance, is going to be a lot more cost-effective than a mandatory program where we say you must have X percent of this type of fuel or that type of fuel. So, recognizing that there will be some cost to meeting our greenhouse gas goals, I think low carbon fuel standard will achieve that in the most cost effective way possible. The key issue is that it phases in over time, so the initial targets are not that stringent, pretty easy to meet, and over time it will be pushing the fuel distribution industry to provide us with cleaner and cleaner fuels. So the average consumer won't see any difference in terms of the performance of the fuels. They won't see any difference in terms of the supply of the fuels. There may be some higher prices for fuels as a result of it.
Representative Benz.
Final short comment. Everything that you've just said suggests that we as a legislature need to give you more direction, because much of what you say, I agree with it, it's not in this bill. And so if you find a position elsewhere, what standard would we have to point at when someone takes your place that has a more aggressive enforcement stance? That's my comment.
Thank you. Look down to this end of the dais for a moment. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking through the PowerPoint from earlier, a number of different existing measures that are listed, CO2 emissions, standard offsets, a few others. Looks like there's already programs in place to regulate greenhouse gas. What does this bill do that's new?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, everything in the bill is new. There are measures that address emissions from the same sectors that the bill addresses, but none of those measures reduce as much greenhouse gas emissions from the sectors as we'll need to. And so this bill takes the next step in each case and adds some additional authority to incrementally get the next bit of greenhouse gas emission reductions. So we currently, with regard to transportation fuel, we have a renewable fuel standard that requires, I think it's 9.2% ethanol.
Oh, yeah.
And 3 to 5% of biodiesel.
Well, 2% and then on to 5% after triggers happen. So yeah.
So those measures will reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but if the ethanol is made in the Midwest from corn, as most of it is now, the amount of greenhouse gas reduction isn't as great as if the ethanol were made from renewable sources or from waste products locally here in Oregon. And so that the idea would be to take the next step and move us towards lower carbon fuels, working together with the renewable fuel standard that you adopted in the 2007 session. So in each sector, we would be building on the strategies we already have, but taking the next step.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Thank you. Just help me understand this. So would it be correct to characterize it as many of the existing measures and your existing authority relates to programs that have an impact on greenhouse gas emission, albeit somewhat indirectly, the ability to require ethanol or building efficiency codes, whereas this would give you the direct authority to regulate the greenhouse gas themselves?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, I think that's correct. Most of the existing regulations on fuel have been implemented by the Department of Energy, and we work together. That's why I asked Rick to be here today on greenhouse gases, so that it's not really important to us which agency has the authority. It's important that we have the authority to take the next step. So many of the measures that are in the governor's package this session would expand existing or add new programs for Department of Energy and other agencies, transportation. The Environmental Quality Commission traditionally has focused on emissions from stacks. We've focused on setting emission standards for traditional pollutants that come out of a tailpipe or come out of a stack. And in the case of greenhouse gases, there are some strategies that can be implemented that way, but many strategies really have to do with the content of a product. So how much carbon is in the gasoline, or are high global warming potential gases used as propellants in a consumer product? And the Commission currently doesn't have authority to regulate that. We have to wait till it's emitted and set a standard. With regard to greenhouse gases, there aren't really adequate technologies in most cases to control carbon dioxide once it's been emitted, so the idea is to reduce it before it's emitted, and that's why we need some new authority.
Final follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Final follow-up.
I'd echo Representative Bence's comments that it sounds to me a little bit like there are some specific policies and programs that you have in mind already underneath this bill that it would give you authorization to do, and I think it would be helpful to be able to see what some of those are and to be able to examine that in more detail.
Thank you, Representative Bailey. I know Representative Boone.
Thank you. And I noted, I looked a little closer while I was listening to everybody else, and this in Section 3.1, it says that EQC may adopt by rule, so there's not the shall word at that point. But then shall's down below, consider safety, feasibility, and cost effectiveness, and may differentiate between different areas of the state, different greenhouse gases, and different categories of substances, et cetera. And then you said it was going to be phased in, but it declares an emergency. So I'm just kind of, does that just mean the policy part of this bill is in effect immediately, or how does that factor in?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, thank you for pointing that out, because there's nothing in the bill that mandates the Commission to adopt any regulation on any particular schedule. It's authority, and the idea is that, particularly with greenhouse gases, the technology is advancing, the policy understanding and science is advancing, and so we want to be positioned when the time is right to implement measures. And so, for example, the low carbon fuel standard, as I mentioned, California is planning on adopting in April. It's possible they could be delayed a little bit, but they're pretty close. They've been working on it, and we would want to take action on low carbon fuels after California, because we want to take advantage of everything that they learn while we're adopting a standard for ourselves. So it's permissive. It's not mandate. There's no schedules. There's no requirements, except that if the Commission does move forward, they are required to consider cost effectiveness, feasibility, and safety. And that's critical, because in many of these areas, as I mentioned, some of these products there are no substitutes, and or there are no effective or safe cost effective substitutes. So the Commission will take action gradually over many, many years in implementing the statute. You asked us another part of your question.
Just the emergency part of it.
Yeah, so the emergency clause allows the authority to go into effect, but there's no automatic implementation of any requirements.
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard a theme, I think, from several other members about the breadth of this bill, and I'm wondering if it is possible to tease out any additional standards that the legislature might require the Commission to apply in order to implement these the proposed rules or the proposed statute in rule. I think in general. And I'm not sure this is a question to answer today, but it's one I sure hope you think about. The proposal is extremely broad, and yet your explanations in many cases are much narrower than that, as Representative Benz pointed out. I'm wondering if there is a way to maintain at least some of the flexibility you want and yet get more specific about the direction and goals that the commission may actually have in mind as it writes these rules in the statute.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, we will certainly work on that after this hearing and before your work session. I think some of the stakeholders have mentioned various ideas to me of ways to make the authority more specific. I think it is important that we maintain flexibility. As I mentioned, this is a rapidly advancing field, and we don't know exactly what type of, for example, when we're talking about idling restrictions right now, the best strategies we have are, as I mentioned, the plug-in options at truck stops and auxiliary power units. There may well be the next technology that comes along, or the next sector where we figure out a way that it makes sense, and Representative Boone, in a very flexible way. Obviously, in agriculture, you're going to have to be idling. There's not going to be any ever under this bill a restriction that would say you can't idle at all. But there would be certain circumstances, for example, you know, when you're perhaps delivering to a warehouse and you're going to be there for more than a certain amount of time, that you would shut the engine down, unless there was some refrigerator unit, in which case you would have to have some alternative. So that's why there are so many different possible configurations that, Representative Barnhart, we would have to have some flexibility to figure out how to apply them over time. But I absolutely agree with you. We could have more criteria in the bill that would have legislative direction and intent on how we apply that authority, and we will work on that.
And I'm going to get Representative Gilliam for perhaps a final question to you, Andy, but a comment that it would be helpful if we're going to move, if this committee is going to feel satisfied moving in this direction, it might be helpful to see examples of other places in statute where we have turned over some relatively broad authority with some parameters to the agency. I'm thinking of, for example, appliance energy efficiency, where I believe, you know, it's a moving target. California does set standards. We want to have the flexibility to match those standards. So my recollection is that we haven't put the appliance energy efficiency standards, you know, in law specifically. But just to satisfy this committee that this would not be unprecedented to delegate this kind of authority. That's a comment. And Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I still have this feeling when you answer that we are moving from the goals of 07 to making it mandatory, goals to mandatory in 09 if we pass this bill. I do appreciate your comment about you look forward to working with the stakeholders. I don't know to what extent they had input here, but if we pass this, it's not our intention today, but if we pass this in this form or something close to it, how long would it take your agency to do the writing and implement the rules, do you think? Can you estimate that the way it is now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, as I mentioned, we're requesting through the governor's budget two new positions to help us implement this bill. But we're not going to get them until the earliest would be the last 6 months of the biennium. And as we all know, the way the budget is, we may or may not have any new positions. But we will be using some existing resources because, as I mentioned, there's a big overlap between reducing greenhouse gases and reducing other pollutants. That said, for example, a low-carbon fuel standard will take us most of next biennium to develop. If California finishes their rule in April, the Northeast states are still developing theirs. We'll want to take advantage of the research that they do and look at that. We'll have an advisory committee. That committee will probably, you know, meet for 6 months or so to go through all the ins and outs and details of it. And then we would start an administrative rulemaking process that would take us a year. So in all likelihood, we would have a standard adopted sometime shortly before the 2011 session, and that it would have a 10-year phase-in schedule. So it would be a slow process.
Follow up.
Thank you. One quick follow-up to that. Then, if that's true, and by the way, you're not from California, are you?
No.
Okay, good.
I said that word too many times today, haven't I?
Would it be likely that the feds would have already acted if we had to wait that long to do this? You don't have a crystal ball, but you must have some feeling about that.
Rick might have to help me out on this, but I'm not aware of the feds considering a low-carbon fuel standard nationally. It is possible. One of the reasons that many states are moving forward with certain greenhouse gas measures is to spur federal action. And if we do get a federal low-carbon fuel standard, obviously we won't need to go forward with our own. But we don't have any schedule for a federal standard. And because of the nature of a standard like this, we won't be worse off as a state if we start down the path towards developing our infrastructure. If there is a federal standard and we've already been a year or two ahead in developing through a state standard, we're more likely to be well positioned to comply with the federal standard and, in fact, maybe help develop some of our biofuels infrastructure here in Oregon so that we can supply some of the other states. So I don't think the potential for a future federal standard is a reason not to act. We certainly, once there is a federal standard, we won't have dueling requirements.
Thank you, Mr. Ginsburg. And I'm cognizant of the time and the fact that we have the Deputy Executive Officer of the California Air Resources Board available by phone for at least the next few minutes. I wanted to get to him, then I'll start pulling up panels. But
he's from California.
Yes, he is from California.
Thank you for that.
Tell us all about it. So we'll bring him up by phone. While we do that, see, you're calling. Okay. While we do that, I want to draw the committee's attention to a handout that should be at the dais. It's titled Criteria to Consider as We Evaluate Agency Proposals. I wanted to say a few words about this, perhaps to save us some time when we move to work session. With my vice chairs, Representative Smith and Representative Gilliam, we developed a set of questions that we thought were just sort of interesting, important, neat questions that we might be considering as we evaluate proposals. And I think we had, at least initially, had in mind the kind of fee proposal that Water Resources Department brought to us and that we'll be discussing in a few minutes. But these, in fact, are quite general questions for us to ask of agencies. My hope is that our discussion about those bills, the water resources bills, and perhaps any bills, might be organized in part around these questions. And when we do move into work session, I'll be asking our committee administrator, Beth, to take some notes on our thoughts that might fall under one or more of these six headings, and to accompany our vote down to Ways and Means, assuming it goes that direction, we will provide a letter from the committee saying, here are some of the things we talked about, and you have the results of our vote. Here's a kind of attempt to add some color to that vote by characterizing our discussion around these six criteria that we've identified. I consider this very much an experiment, very much a work in progress. Would be interested in your input, feedback, thoughts. If this is a useful exercise, great. If not, we can scrap it. It's a chance to experiment. And I don't, is this posted out there? I don't know if it's available to the audience. It deals with questions, and we'll talk more about it in a few minutes, but it deals with issues like innovation, communication, measurement and outcomes, economic multipliers, fairness and priorities. And really, a lot of credit goes to Representative Smith for helping generate our thinking on this. I think Representative Gilliam and I owe him thanks for most of the legwork on this. So that's hopefully can help frame our discussion when we get to those bills in a few moments, but may have some bearing on, as I think Representative Boone noted, may have some bearing on this proposal too. We have Mr. Schiebel on the phone. Mike, I don't know if I'm...
1 sec, she's going to put him here.
Hi, is this Mike
Scheibel?
I knew I'd get your name wrong. This is Representative Cannon, Chair of the Environment and Water Committee here in Oregon. Thank you for joining us. We have a nearly full house for your testimony today, and I know that we'll be interested in hearing where you are in developing a low-carbon fuel standard for California. So if you'd like to begin, and I think we have a few minutes for your testimony and then probably some interest in a question or two afterwards.
Okay, I've been listening in online to your hearing. So
super.
Your your stuff for time. I'm Mike Scheibel. I'm the Deputy Executive Officer of the California Air Resources Board, and the staff under me, about 30 of them, are working to develop a low-carbon fuel standard for California. And what this standard will do, as described to you, is it will, in the early years, put a very gentle slope on introducing lower-carbon fuels, and then by 2020, we'll achieve about a 10% reduction in the carbon intensity of the fuels used in transportation in California. We are doing environmental and cost assessments and also feasibility assessments of this. It builds on this federal renewable fuel standard, which affects only biofuels, but we've expanded it so that lower carbon fuels such as natural gas or hydrogen or electricity will also be part of the mix. And fuels that do better than the standard create credits that can then be marketed to companies that want to use them to offset higher carbon fuels. And I know there's been a lot of discussion on the impact of this. I think the impact, as far as we can see, is we will produce 2 to 3 times the global warming benefits over the federal program that's in place that's going to bring us a lot of biofuels. We'll produce a situation where firms that are considering going into the biofuel business or providing electricity or other low-carbon fuels to transportation will see an economic advantage and have an incentive to do so. And we think over time this will have little cost impacts because our projections are that the price of petroleum, which is the fuel we're displacing, are going to go up and up and up once we get out of the economic crisis that we're in, and that the biofuels or electricity or other fuels that come in will actually be offered to the consumer at a lower price per mile traveled. And I think I'll just end it there. We're scheduled to release our proposal in early March and go to our board in late April for a decision on adopting a regulation, and we hope to have it up and running in 2011.
Great, thank you. Are there questions? Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Chair Cannon. Thank you for joining us. I'm curious, as you're going through your process in developing and fleshing out the low-carbon fuel standard, do you take into account non-fuel items that relate to CO2 output from the transportation sector? For example, if you were to reduce CO2 output from transportation sector and combustion of fuels through conversion to more bicycle or pedestrian-friendly neighborhoods, land use conversions, public transit, does that factor into the equation, or is it purely focused on the fuel itself?
The low-carbon fuel standard is focused on the fuel and lowering the carbon intensity of the fuel. We have another program that was just adopted by our legislature last year, SB 375, where we are actually putting together guidance that will affect land use and transportation decisions at the regional and city level, and that's the mechanism that we see as using for getting to the let's get to ways of moving about that are more sustainable and have lower carbon consequences. And that, of course, is combined with the PALI program, which for the exhaust emission standards, which Oregon has opted into.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For our direction, possibly you could share with us the direction you received from the California legislature in the bill that authorized you to proceed as you are now proceeding.
Okay. The authorization that we got from the California legislature wasn't for the low-carbon fuel standard in particular. We are acting under our Assembly Bill AB 32, which told the California Air Resources Board to play a lead role in doing everything that's technologically feasible and cost-effective to reduce the global warming emissions in California back to their 1990 levels by 2020. So the low-carbon fuel standard is a major part of that effort. And Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, about 2 years ago, issued an executive order that basically told us to start developing the program. It was based upon a 6-month study by the University of California, Berkeley, and University of California, Davis, to design the initial parts of the program, and we're now turning it into regulations. So we're acting under the general authority that we have to reduce emissions from transportation and stationary sources in order to achieve a statewide goal.
So just to be clear, you have, in fact, you have the authority, but it has not been specifically granted in law. There's no reference to low-carbon fuel standard in California statute. You're acting under a broader delegation of authority.
That's correct. There's no requirement in law to do a low-carbon fuel standard.
Okay. Any other questions? Or well, thank you very much for joining us. This is helpful, and appreciate your time.
Thank you, and good luck with your efforts. And if you need to contact us, we'll be willing to collaborate.
Okay, we'll be watching with interest. Thanks.
Okay, fine.
All right. I'm going to call up a panel now and ask Bob Russell, John Chandler, and Paul Romaine to come forward.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I'd like to talk to you a little bit about House Bill 2186 this afternoon. Mr. Ginsburg, I think, did an outstanding job sort of going through the bill. He also did a very good job in talking about a lot of the efforts that we already have underway to address a lot of these issues. First, you know, I'd like to start by saying that the trucking industry clearly understands that climate change is happening. We are not disputing that in any way. We also understand that we have a responsibility to be part of the solution, and we're more than willing to do that, and we believe we have been working in that direction. However, in 2008, there were 3,065 trucking companies that had five or more trucks that went bankrupt in this country. There were thousands more smaller trucking companies that also went out of business during that period of time. Last year, there were 110,000 Oregonians that were employed in the trucking industry. Unfortunately, this year, because of the combination of volatile fuel prices and a much worse economy, my members find themselves in the position of selling trucks and laying off employees. But I think the more important point is not the impact of all of this on the trucking industry. I think the important point is the impact on Oregon's economy. Today, the trucking industry transports about 72% of the tons of freight in Oregon. And what we like to say is, if you've got it, a truck brought it. To the extent that our costs are impacted, there certainly is the potential for a ripple effect that can impact the entire economy. However, when you look at House Bill 2186, particularly the low carbon fuel standard, I mean, it affects all of the freight modes, trucks, boats, planes, and trains, but it also affects all the passenger modes, cars, buses, all of those things. So it has a pretty broad impact on our transportation system. I'm not going to repeat any of the things that Mr. Ginsburg said, but I would like to make a couple of points. As far as the low-carbon fuel standard, there isn't one in existence today. California, as you heard, is developing one. The northeastern states are considering, but there isn't one in existence. So from my point of view, we really don't know what it means. And it scares us a lot because we don't know what it means. And providing DEQ with the authority to proceed, that's a significant concern. Although I learned a whole lot more about a low-carbon fuel standard this afternoon. And I think what Mr. Ginsburg described was a cap-and-trade system with caps, offsets, all of those kinds of things. I know we're going to have a discussion of that later in the week. I believe your committee is going to join the Senate committee. We're going to talk about Senate Bill 80. There were a couple of things that we are doing today that Mr. Ginsburg didn't address. We have another Oregon Solutions project going on right now dealing with the ports, both the trucks, ships, port equipment, all that kind of stuff. The convener of that Oregon Solutions project is Jay Waldron, who was former chair of the Port of Portland Commission. It's been up and running for a couple of months, and we are very hopeful that it will come up with some voluntary ways that we can significantly address emissions around our ports, both in Oregon and Washington. Another program that Mr. Ginsburg didn't mention, which surprised me, is the Clean Diesel Program that was enacted by the Oregon Legislature in 2007, which is under his area of responsibility. That program, as you recall, provides for retrofits for all types of diesel engines, not just trucks, but stationary, mobile, all kinds of sources. And while that program is primarily focused on particulate emissions, it also reduces a significant amount of global warming gases, not necessarily carbon, but some of the other that are actually more damaging to the environment. Another program that has sort of been going on for a number of years now is under an agreement with the Environmental Protection Agency, the trucking industry, and this is mobile diesels, have been on a path to clean up the emissions generally from our diesel engines. In 2004, we had a new engine that dramatically reduced the NOx from our diesel engines. 2006, we implemented an ultra low sulfur diesel, which took much of the sulfur out of diesel, which was in preparation for our 2007 engines, which in fact have the particulate traps. We have one more version of engine coming in 2010, and that will again drop the NOx significantly. And so these new engines are reducing all forms of emissions, including greenhouse gases. One of the things that I like to say is that when we have the 2010 engines, the exhaust is going to be cleaner than the air is currently in downtown Portland, and we're just going to route that into the cab of the truck in the interest of our driver's health. We are also working on hybrid trucks, believe it or not, many of our members. Fuel cells and LNG-powered trucks. So in combination with the incentive programs that Mr. Ginsburg described that hits all of the points contained in this bill, there's a number of other things that we are currently doing. However, from the transportation sector as a whole's point of view, there is more to be done, and we are certainly willing to step up to the plate. From November of 2007 through December of 2008, the governor convened a large group of people to work on transportation funding. That group actually was comprised of six different committees. One of the committees was chaired by Gail Achterman, who's the chair of the Transportation Commission, and it was the Environmental Committee. There were a number of folks that were on that committee, myself representing the trucking industry, Craig Campbell representing the automobile folks, and a lot of the environmental interests, many of which are in this room. Through that process, we developed a number of initiatives that we plan to put in the transportation funding package. And the document that I passed out to you is a description of those initiatives, and I'd like to go through them quickly because we're offering these initiatives as an alternative, certainly, to 2186.
And quickly, Mr. Russell, we're going to have to move into work session here on our other bills, so if you would try to wrap up.
I will very quickly. We want a dedicated fund for transit and other alternative modes. We currently have a dedicated highway fund. We'd like a dedicated fund for transit. And we want to do least cost planning for transportation, which is a sort of concept that comes out of the utilities, but will help us get at VMT reductions for discretionary transportation. We want to change the method of cost allocation so that there's true pricing for use of our transportation system. Today, all we're pricing is asphalt. We're not pricing the full cost, including replacement cost, and the cost of emissions and other kinds of externalities. We want to eliminate highway bottlenecks because free-flowing highways put out less carbon than when we're stuck in gridlock. And we also want to provide additional funding for the Clean Diesel Program, which I mentioned earlier. And Mr. Ginsburg talked extensively about how we use the BETC tax credits to reduce fuel consumption today, and we'd like additional support for the BETC program. And that concludes my testimony.
Great. And will you be able to stick around while we do this work session in order to respond to any questions?
Absolutely.
Afterwards? Thank you. So what I'm going to do then is temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 2186 and open a work session on House Bill 2231. Ask Director Ward and anyone that you want to bring up from the agency to describe the Dash 1 amendment. And then take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Phil Ward with the Water Resources Department. Tom Paul and Brenda Bateman have joined me. Tom's our deputy, and Brenda is our senior policy coordinator. By way of reminder, Mr. Chair, members, the issue before you this afternoon, House Bill 2331, raises a fee that our agency collects.
231.
Excuse me, 2231. Raises a fee that our agency collects, known as the start card fee, from $125 to $225. It has funded, this program and fee has funded since 1997, 10.88 FTE. That supports our well inspection and our well log program. And if not implemented, we'll be looking at a 4-5 position reduction in that program. There are amendments for your consideration this afternoon, Dash 1 amendments. Those amendments simply add an effective date for the Act of July 1st of this year. So, Mr. Chair, with that brief introduction and description of the Dash 1 amendments, we'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Questions for the Director Ward? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just so I'm clear, and I think you just said this, the money raised by this increase in fee is going to be used for the well drilling program. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct. This supports our well inspection program and the well log program that places this information in the database and on the web.
Thank you.
Other questions for the director? What I will do, if you just hang out for a moment in case things come up, but if we could get a motion on the Dash 1 amendments.
So moved.
Go ahead.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated January 27, 2009.
And Representative Smith moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated January 27, 2009. Is there any discussion on the Dash 1s? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so moved. The amendments are adopted. And we'll get a motion now on the bill and then have discussion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2231 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Smith moves House Bill 2231 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Members, I note that this bill does have that prior reference to Ways and Means, and so that will be its next stop, despite, for new members, despite that confusing verbiage here in the motion, this will, in fact, go to Ways and Means before it comes to the floor. Representative Bernhardt.
Well, simply to note, Mr. Chair, the form of the motion is because the bill goes from here back to the clerk's desk, from the clerk's desk to the Ways and Means Committee. That's the reason why it's worded that way.
That was explained to me one time. I had forgotten that. Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just say quickly, I can't support this bill, and it has very little to do with the testimony or the importance of the well inspection and log program. I think you understand this, but I want to make sure I'm on record to say, as serious as our economic situation is, with the lack of any significant action on the floor and fiscal matters, I think it ill behooves us to send fee bills from all of our committees before we make some of those recommendations. So I can't support it. It affects folks in my rural district in terms of another $125 for a well. And I think until we see a bigger fiscal picture, we need to wait on fee bills, and that's my reason. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you, Representative Gilliam. I want to note for the record that we do have additional testimony from the Sunrise Water Authority, from Riverside, Inc., and guess that's it. We have a fiscal statement from Legislative Fiscal Office in compliance with our rules that don't allow us to move a bill without fiscal. And again, draw the committee's attention to the criteria that Representative Smith and Gilliam were so good to develop. And any comments that folks have on any of the 6 points or questions that we developed would be useful now if we're going to provide any of our thinking down to Ways and Means as they consider this bill in the context of the Water Resources Department budget.
Yeah, my hope is that we will continue to sort of look on these and guide future testimony, right, in advance so people can see these. For people who are here, take a look at criteria and say, oh, we might tailor our testimony to some of that, maybe even provide written stuff. I remarked, or at least noted in the testimony we heard the other day, some of the innovative stuff they're working to do. In fact, some of the stuff they're doing is in the cutting edge in the country. I think that it behooves us, whatever our political stripe, to be at the cutting edge of the country and how efficiently we develop our land use practices and our water practices. So I did notice that. Another thing I wanted to note on one question that was relevant to me and Representative Boone heard from you, I think it also matters to districts like ours that are hit by the economic crisis with particular force, that most of the folks who pay this fee are people in the business are able to figure it out within the plans of their kind of economic acting, and the and so it didn't seem to target folks in a really unfair way. The fee did seem to have a nexus to what we were doing. So those are two comments that I have.
Is there further discussion? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a remark on Representative Smith's and your other two efforts. I've already handed this outline out to 4 different folks that visited me today, utilizing it just exactly as Representative Smith suggested. I think it's a great thing to focus those giving us testimony. So I've used it already. So thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Representative,
quick point of order. We and Representative from my right might help us as well. If we wanted to suggest, not that it would pass, but if we wanted to suggest that we send it with a neutral recommendation, are we past that point?
I do not believe so. I think that you are welcome to make that motion.
Then, if you recognize me for that purpose, I'll
do
so.
I recognize you for that purpose.
I move that we, if we send this,
That we do it with a neutral recommendation.
I think that the motion is to move House Bill 2231 as amended to the floor with a neutral recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. And my understanding then is that if this motion was adopted, we'd then have a subsequent discussion and debate about this. This is a motion to amend motion.
Yes.
So, in fact, your motion is to amend the previous motion. So, that's the motion to amend the previous motion to send this bill to the floor with no recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there discussion on the motion to amend the previous motion, Representative Barnhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe we should recommend the bill to the Ways and Means Committee, so I will oppose the amendment.
Thank you. Is there further discussion? Representative Smith.
As a general matter, we haven't discussed this as a body, and to the people who are going to have to sit in these hearings for a long time because you have multiple clients, multiple people you work with, what the heck is going on? Part of what we've been talking about is that we send, and I think the structural defect or structural challenge of how we make decisions, that we send binary signals. We make yay or nay, you know, one or zero decisions in policy committees, and then ask people in Ways and Means to make priority decisions, and any spending or any ask for taxation or fees is a priority-based decision. And how can we, after we hear all this marvelous testimony, send some priority-based signals to people who are going to make later decisions so we don't give a relatively meaningless or, you know, undermeaninged yay vote to folks who then have to make a priority determination. So my sense is, and one way we can do this was the neutral or the due pass, and I say this for the record because I hope the people smarter than I will continue, and I'm happy to help, conversation about how we can make the process slightly better or maybe much better in terms of how we signal. I am with Representative Barnhart that my sense is if we sent a neutral signal that in these economic times that would be too close to a death knell signal, so I would recommend a positive signal and at the same time hope. It was much of Representative Gilliam's comments about how can we add a little more robust texture to these determinations that led us to try to come up with some criteria, but I would join Representative Barnhart in thinking that do pass would be more helpful, so I will oppose the amendment.
Further discussion, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As much as I'd like to join Representative Gilliam in his motion, because I agree with him that I very much wish that all of these spending bills could be looked at in one large group. On the other hand, I am extremely aware of the need for the data on these wells. I know just exactly how much I use them in my practice, and they're hugely necessary. So I too, must oppose this motion.
Thank you. Further discussion? Will the clerk please call the roll?
Mr. Chair, point of order. This is voting on the amendment on the motion.
That is correct. This is voting on Representative Gilliam's motion to amend our motion to substitute neutral for due pass.
You need a jumbotron or something.
Yes. It can get very confusing. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Bailey?
No.
Representative Barnhart?
No.
Representative Benz?
No.
Representative Boone?
No.
Representative Jensen?
No.
Vice Chair Smith?
No.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
No, and the motion fails. So we are still with the motion that Representative Smith made, and is there further discussion? Seeing none, I'd like to thank the department for their good work and responsiveness. I actually will make one more comment about the communication criterion on the handout. There was, during the course of the last week or two, some concern about the level of communication between...
Cliff?
We're gonna vote one more in 1 second, Representative Benz. There was some concern raised about the degree to which you had effectively communicated with the primary stakeholders in this on this bill, the well drillers, and understand that as this goes to Ways and Means, you'll be continuing to try to make sure that they have full understanding of how this money is spent, and look forward to seeing you successful in that endeavor to sync up with them. So thank you for your continued work on this.
Absolutely.
And will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Bailey? Aye. Representative Barnhart? Aye. Representative Benz? Aye. Representative Boone? Aye. Representative Vice Chair Smith? Aye. Vice Chair Gilliam? No. Chair Cannon? Aye.
The motion passes and the bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 2231 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2186, and I'll invite the folks who are here, if they are still here, to return to the stand.
Do you want any questions after each?
Let's see if Mr. Russell has concluded, then we'll move on, and then we'll increase the time and try to get to the whole panel. Do you have a question?
If Mr. Russell,
what I'm going to suggest is that we actually hear from all three and then ask our questions. So,
absolutely, Mr. Chair.
Hold on. I want to give you the opportunity
Mr. Chair,
to finish.
I'm finished.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you for staying with us during the delay. Mr. Romaine or Mr. Chandler?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland. I'm here representing the Oregon Petroleum Association. We don't like House Bill 2186 as it is currently drafted. One of probably the biggest problem I have with this is a comment that was made earlier by Representative Benz, which is this really should be six or five, whatever the number is, six specific bills. You're ducking your policy role. You're basically giving to the agency the opportunity to really be very creative without a heck of a lot of direction. The specific thing that I'm worried about is E, under 3.3.1E. Requirements for motor vehicle service providers to check and inflate tire pressure according to manufacturer-recommended specifications. Well, a motor vehicle service provider could be a gas station, basically. And depending how active folks get, we could basically be mandated to check tire pressure every time somebody comes out in to fill up with gas. Now, that's probably not where they wanted to go, but that's not limited here. And if you do that, you have really sent the price of gas skyrocketing in this state. It's bad enough now. We have probably the highest cost of delivery of that gas in the country, thanks to no cell service and other little quirks of the Oregon system. But please understand that mandating this kind of stuff has a lot of cost to it. If you mandate, basically right now, tomorrow I'm having my oil changed by a guy here in Salem, and he's going to check my tires and do everything, and he's not going to charge me for it. That's what he does. I like him for doing that. But if there's a movie, I think it was Field of Dreams, you know, if you build it, they will come. Well, I can guarantee you, if you mandate, they will charge. Because now you have a government mandate, they have to check tire pressure, so they're going to charge you for that checking of tire pressure. So this is something that goes on. It will go on. It's a good thing to do. Most people should be aware of, with all the publicity on mileage, that you do get better mileage if your tires are inflated. It's not something you need to do as government, and we would ask you to kind of slow down a little bit here and not go that far. Thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler. I'm with the Oregon Home Builders Association. I'm also appearing here as a de facto spokesperson for Oregonians for Balanced Climate Policy, which is a group of businesses that have pulled together during the interim and for this session to address the issue of greenhouse gases, energy efficiency, and climate change. And I want to make it real clear at the outset that we have no intention, as Mr. Russell indicated in his testimony, of arguing the point. We believe there is a problem. We believe that we need to address it. Having said that, and I want you to please keep that in mind as you consider this bill and other bills that are coming through this body, the fact that we agree about the problem doesn't necessarily mean we're going to agree to all the specifics of how to address that problem. Case in point, House Bill 2186. But I do want to go back. This is unprecedented. I've been kicking around this process for quite a while. We have never seen this broad of a coalition. The utilities have pulled together all the electrics. They can speak to this themselves, but for the first time in my memory, all their logos appeared on one letterhead, both private and publics, talking about their piece of the climate change puzzle. In our coalition, we have ag and timber and builders and industry and petroleum and truckers and you name it, all pulling together, all of us with slightly different pieces of the climate change puzzle, all of us committed publicly on the record to helping you and helping the agencies and helping the state move forward with it. This is a legitimate and sincere attempt on our part. We will be bringing a bill forward. It's in drafting right now. Your guess is as good as ours as to when it might pop out of LC, which is going to have many of these parts already in it. It's because of that effort and that commitment that we're very concerned about 2186 and that we have so many different bills in front of us in two chambers, in various committees, all taking slightly different looks at the elephant without any sort of a holistic approach as to the triage, which should go first, who should be in charge of which part of it, how many different agencies, entities, and programs are going to be created. We believe that to address this issue, we need to be much more holistic about it, and we need to start by claiming what we've already done. Oregon has done a phenomenal job. According to the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, which is as neutral a third party from an industry standpoint as you could possibly find, they found Oregon is number two in the country, right behind California, in terms of energy efficiency. We are doing a great job. We have a great transportation planning system. We've already done, as Mr. Russell indicated, a lot of work on fuel standards, truck standards, efficiency standards. We have taken industry to extremes that no other state does. We've taken builders to extremes that no other state does. We are at the table, and we are, in fact, leading, and I think we ought to be claiming that, marketing it, going out as part of our economic development strategy, and to be smart about how we move forward from that very legitimately base we can be very legitimately proud of. 2186, specifically, Mr. Chairman, and you'll hear more about the sermon at a later date on other bills, I'm sure, so with your permission, I'll keep the soapbox handy. With regard to this bill, there's some specific concerns on the language. If you look at lines, where to go here, line 11 through 13, where the EQC may adopt by rule the following to help the state achieve the greenhouse gas emissions reduction goals specified in ORS 468A.205. That was passed last session, that particular section is cross-referenced, and that contained the, at the time, aspirational greenhouse gas reduction goals, and here we are 2 years later with what looked fairly non-aspirational thoughts on how we might achieve them. That concerns us. If we're going to have a conversation about turning aspirational goals into mandates, we ought to have that conversation, not by cross-reference. Some of that came out in the questions during Mr. Ginsburg's testimony. I think those are good questions. I think there's more discussion on that point. Frankly, those may be perfectly fine goals, may be perfectly fine to talk about the specifics on how to address them. It ought to be done legislatively, not by agency action separately, which leads me to my second point of broad concern about this bill. This bill, Senate Bill 80, there's several other delegation bills that you'll see potentially this session, are giving a lot of extra work to the Department of Environmental Quality. I think this DEQ is running better than it ever has. I think we have an extraordinarily good staff there. We have been very pleased with the relationship we've developed with DEQ on a variety of topics, and for an industry lobbyist to say that about an environmental regulatory agency is, I think, a credit to the agency's work and how fair and how equitably they handled a very difficult task. Do not give them more to do than they can bear. If you give them too much, regardless of how well managed they are, regardless of the talent of the staff, you might as well close the agency down. The fact is, the climate change issue is so big and so multifaceted that it's, I think, would strategically be a mistake to give it to the one agency because it'll collapse it. But it's not fair to that agency who has done such a great job on tough issues of water quality, air quality, groundwater, all that. They simply can't keep up with this, and I won't speak to the ways and means issues. I have me doubts about how many FTEs they're going to get out of this session. It doesn't really matter how many FTEs they get. They don't have, there's no way they can do the work. I understand and I appreciate Mr. Ginsburg's coming up and saying they can. I would respectfully disagree with his assessment. I think this bill needs to be, if we're going to go forward with this concept, we need to figure out some other way of addressing it than simply handing it off to another agency. Point two on that topic of delegation. I believe the legislature has the obligation, if you don't mind me getting on a little bit of a civics lecture here, Mr. Chairman, this is the body where those sorts of deliberative discussions ought to take place. To delegate them to an executive branch agency is, I think, if you'll pardon me, an abdication of legislative responsibility and ought not be done lightly. The policy debates and discussions, as was mentioned by Representative Benz and Mr. Romaine just referenced, the four or five different bills that are contained within this one bill are each should be top subjects of broad debate, stakeholder, citizen, open, honest discussion, and regardless of how well-intentioned or how open an agency process is, it is not a substitute for the legislative process, period. That's, I think, something you, on this bill and others, please bear that in mind. You have a job to do, and you ought to do it. We will help you do it. We may argue with you. We may lose votes. We may lose bills. But your job is still your job. Please don't give it to an agency, because that's neither fair to the agency nor to this body. That last comment I want to make, Mr. Chairman, because I know you're pressed for time, and we will come back to this issue. This is a matter of personal privilege, frankly. I noticed last session, some of you may recall, I don't recall the number of the bill, there was an air quality bill that came before you, and I came up, Mr. Ginsburg and I discussed it, and to my chagrin, I noticed the bill as drafted would have caused me last session to have to register my goats, because they were greenhouse gas emitting, goats being gassy little devils. And I noticed, Mr. Chairman, this bill, under lines 15 and 16, as drafted in 2186, I wouldn't have to necessarily register my goats, but I might well have to register my goat feed. And, Mr. Chairman, as a matter of personal privilege, leaving aside my home builder connection, I think that's overly, might be a bit prescriptive. With that, I'll be glad to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chandler. Are there questions about any of the testimony or Mr. Chandler's goats? Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Russell, apologize if I can't clearly remember your testimony at this point, but we'll see. I'm trying to dig into the arguments here and try to understand the specifics of the concerns, and I'm not sure I heard specifics from you. I heard a reference to it being cap and trade, which I don't see that in this bill and wonder where you're getting that from, and I heard a lot of things that the trucking industry is doing positive on climate change, but what are your specific concerns with this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, you know, when I said that the low-carbon fuel standard, specifically, was a cap-and-trade. It's because of some of the things that Mr. Ginsburg said. Like I said in the beginning, a low-carbon fuel standard, we don't have one in existence today. We don't really know what one is. But particularly under questioning when he said that there would be offsets, obviously with low-carbon fuel standard, he described a cap and a ratcheting down. I mean, that sounds like a cap-and-trade system to me. That was the point that I was trying to make. My specifics as far as this bill are concerned, I'm very concerned about increasing the cost, not just to the trucking industry, but to all of transportation, the potential ramifications that has for the economy, and there's so much here that's unknown. Mr. Chandler, I think, did a really good job, and so did Mr. Romaine, in talking about the lack of policy definition in this bill, that it's handing that whole policy-making function off to the executive branch agency, as well as the implementation. And, you know, most of the bills that you will pass here, I think, I mean, you are developing the policy, and the executive branch is the implementer of that policy. Now, I see this one very differently, and that's a concern. And, you know, we fear the unknown, and it creates a huge unknown for us.
Quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. That's a helpful clarification on cost. And I guess I'm just trying to tease out here, if as you each of you mentioned at the beginning of your testimony, that you do believe that climate change is a problem and over time and we must address it, and I take you at your word, over time it seems like we are going to see costs rising. And while I do have some concerns about the breadth of this bill, what's the sort of Why is this going to cost the industry more than, say, other changes that are going to have to happen anyway over time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, I can't quantify the costs here. There's not enough definition to do that. The alternative that we offered, and I didn't spend a lot of time on it, but there's two very significant pieces. It's least cost planning and an efficient method of cost allocation. Both of those concepts really come out of utility regulation, and both of those together will give you the costs, the real costs, of dealing with whatever goal you set for reducing greenhouse gases, and they will be very specific. They're defined processes. I think that alternative is very important, and we support that. And once we know the costs, then you can make a determination, and as long as it's applied across the board so it doesn't have any competitive advantages, disadvantages, it's the level playing field, so to speak, then it makes sense for us to proceed. And we think that the least cost planning and the cost allocation gives us something that we can do, quite frankly, much quicker than the low carbon fuel standard and be more effective.
Thank you. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've been commingling our discussion here with our new 5 criteria. I just want to quickly comment that although I regret that the whole session today has been about Representative Bentz, I did appreciate that he likes them, and so I'd like maybe now to get a little more credit for what we did on this. Anyway.
Credit given.
My question, as tempting as it is to go to the Reverend Chandler, my question is for Mr. Russell. And I'm concerned about this, what I consider to be a bit of a right hand not knowing what the left hand is doing in the executive department. And could you be more specific about how the proposal here came to bear on your volunteer work with the governor's, I'm sorry, I don't have the exact name of it, the governor's transportation task force or work group, because I'm very interested in how the coordination or lack thereof works.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, the contents of House Bill 2186 were not discussed, to my recollection. That was a 14-month effort. were not discussed by the Environmental Committee or, quite frankly, any of the other committees that were involved in the transportation funding debate. The first time that I recall seeing the specifics of 2186 was a conversation with Mr. Ginsburg shortly before the first of the year. So, you know, the things that we're offering as an alternative took months to develop with lots of discussion with a broad range of folks. I don't think you can say the same about the contents in House Bill 2186.
Thanks.
Thank you. And Representative Smith, did you have a
I did.
Question? Was it answered?
It wasn't answered. In the interest of time, I can set it. I can set half of it aside. So I'll keep one question. A few comments. We got the big hitters today, boy. By the way, it's delightful to hear you, and I mean that. This is new for me. We're on day two of week four in my legislative career. I've heard lots about each of you, Mr. Chandler. Let me say thank you for the admission about your goats. My fiance has asked me to admit that perhaps I myself should register myself. lactose intolerant.
Sub D.
Yeah, we can talk about that in the hallway. Let me skip ahead on a couple things. A core question, if we wanted to boil it down to a couple few, is where should, if there should be a holistic conversation take place, where should that conversation take place? And I hear your suggestion and ask that it happened in the legislative body, you know, in committees, and we vote on stuff. And I hear that's one place. We only meet 6 months out of every 2 years, and we're a little slow. Another place is industry, and you guys have your large group, and that is one place, and it represents some very important interests, but not all the interests and not all the public interests. Another place is the DEQ, and that's what we're talking about today. My question is, if at some point we're going to take a yay or nay vote, whether that's going to be the place or not, is there anything in particular, and this can be a question we take offline and think about down the road, but if we're going to make a yay or nay vote on that, is there any way that we could have greater assurances that that location for the holistic conversation takes into account a greater array of interests and stakeholders than it might if we just pass willy-nilly? And Mr. Romaine, if you want to answer, we probably don't have time for three answers, but I don't care which of the three of the answers.
You want to take it or you want me to?
I'll take a quick run on it, Mr. Chair, Representative Smith. I think that you start with a conversation during this legislative process. And in my estimation, that you can set up, we have about half a dozen bills that are floating around that could easily be, the concepts of them could be coalesced into a bigger conversation. I've seen that happen many times over the years. Sometimes it doesn't work. Oftentimes it does work. Okay. And oftentimes the conversation may or may not result in legislation, but you've had people in a room, legislators in a room, public testimony when the bills come forward that actually creates better public policy than when you hand it off to the agency, they have a better sense of where they're supposed to be going with it. That's as good a place to start as any. There are other agencies that haven't been heard from that might have a piece of this, but I think my sense is the first place for that conversation is to kind of get, whether it's in your committee or in the Senate or both, yep, to coalesce the various bills that are on this topic. We saw a slide on them earlier. Yep. I don't want to take a quiz on the numbers right now. And start figuring out which ones ought to be talked about first and which sequence. There's a lot of work already being done on this, private and public. Here's the time for the next ever how many months to have that conversation, because when you guys go home, when you sign and die, we need to know which way we're going as a state, both from an economic standpoint and regulatory standpoint. The agencies need to know. The budget have to address that. I think we have time to do it. It'd be a lot of work, but it would just be condensed work. It'd be a lot more to do it after the fact, arguing in every agency, city council, and other institution around the state. And I'd like to volunteer both these guys to be on the work group.
Mr. Ray, briefly.
I don't do anything briefly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Romaine again. I have some very specific things. First of all, don't put me on a panel with Chandler anymore. But second of all, to the EQC, the rule process that EQC goes through, I just went through with some other rules, and it's you're so removed from their legislative adoption. You basically go through the rules proposed by DEQ, then you go through the hearing process, and you can talk to members of the EQC up until the time that the record closes for the hearing, and then you can't talk to them anymore. So the record closes in, say, September, and you can't talk to them until they make their decision. The only people who can talk to them are the staff. That's by their rules. So it was probably the most closed rule process. Excuse me, I didn't just go through puberty. The closed rule process I'd ever been through. But you are a very open legislative body. And that's very good. You can listen to everybody up until the time that you take your vote. You have access to all types of point of view, and that's not to say that the staff reporting isn't very good, because it is. DEQ is a wonderful agency, actually. They're very competent. They know what they're doing. But there's just a sort of a sense of you've lost it. It's just out there, and it's now just whatever the staff's going to do is they're going to do to you. So that's why we would highly encourage you on these very big policy issues to at least hone down what you're going to do. And on my particular issue, just tell me that gas stations aren't going to have to go out there and check tire pressure all the time, and I'll leave. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Romaine, and we've been especially open to you. If I recall, we began with your panel at a couple of minutes after four. It is 10 to 5. I know part of that time we were working another bill. Do appreciate hearing from you. We are, for the audience's attention, we're going to be carrying on until about 5:15, and I'm hoping to hear two more panels. We have 17 witnesses, more witnesses signed up to testify. We will have another hearing on this bill. That is my expectation anyway. And thank you. I'll have some folks whose names I don't know. They are testifying in support of the bill, but because I don't know their names, I expect that they are not in the building every day. And I'm going to ask them to join us next, and that would include Bill Harris, Chris Bacon, and Jeff Kim to join us. And again, my hope is to have one additional panel after this. So if you can, we can spend no more than about 10 to 13 minutes, please. And whoever would like to begin.
That's the right work last time. We'll work that way this time. I'm Chris Bakken. It was a very, very good attempt. It's been massacred and far worse than that. Thank you, Chairman. And thank you, rest of the committee, for hearing us today. I listened to the previous testimony with a lot of interest. I am with Synchromotive. We build controllers and power systems for electric vehicle, for the nascent electric vehicle industry, and also work with my colleague Jeff Kim to build charging stations for tomorrow's electric vehicles. I look at this, and from my view, this is it's a building block. It's a building block to growth. It attracts job growth. When I was first asked to come, I thought, low carbon standards, what's the opposite? It's high carbon standards. That's where we are today. That's a maze. It's a rat trap. No chunk of cheese at the end. Only way in is the same way we came. Only way out is the same way we came in. And I say that as a building block because it pushes and incentivizes, and I very much appreciate the trucking comments and some of the comments I heard from you about incentives. It incentivizes us providing products and services that will provide cost savings at the expense of the status quo or high carbon fuel standards. In our area, we're developing charging stations. A vehicle that's charged is reducing carbon. I'm a father of future Oregonians. I look at our education system. It doesn't support high carbon fuel. There's no jobs in high carbon fuel standards. There are jobs in low carbon fuel standards and what that builds. By 2018, by some estimates, there will be 15 million plug-in hybrids or battery electric vehicles on the road. Oregon stands to capitalize on that. We have facilities, we have educational programs already in place that cater to that industry. I want to see us there. And I, if low carbon standards help us in that, as once again the building block, I'm all for them. We have a port ready to accept automobiles from Asia, or we have the intelligence and the willingness to build those vehicles right here. And some of those people are in the room today. We've got to support that. If there's a balancing act, and trucking is surely important to us, if there's a balancing act in there, I appreciate your responsibility and the effort you have to go through to do that. But I do encourage you, I'll try to wrap up here, I do encourage you to help us put these building blocks in place to allow industries like mine, businesses like mine, small employers, succeed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bakken.
Thank you.
My name is Bill Harris. I'm the Chief Operations Officer for Cascade Sierra Solutions, and we do support the SmartWay upgrades on trucks throughout the state of Oregon. Cascade Sierra Solutions is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to implement clean diesel trucking technology on the West Coast border and throughout the United States. Since our inception in 2006, CSS has facilitated the upgrade of over 2,400 trucks and saved over 3.62 million gallons of fuel, and this number grows daily. This has reduced over 36,530 metric tons of carbon dioxide from being emitted to the atmosphere. We provide education to the trucking industry, and by partnering with the State of Oregon, Department of Energy, and Department of Transportation, Umpqua Bank, we've been able to provide $3.2 million worth of low-cost loans to upgrade trucks. There are several models of idle reduction equipment, such as auxiliary power units, that reduce fuel usage, or fuel idling, by 80% on their fuel usage. I had an answer from Ms. Boone on one of her problems there. Trucks typically idle when stopped to provide essential comforts to the operator, such as heating and cooling, and burn a rate of 1.2 to 1.6 gallons of fuel an hour, or approximately 12 to 16 gallons of fuel a day. Auxiliary power units burn approximately 0.2 gallons per hour, provide heating, cooling, and 110-volt AC power to run appliances, saving 10 to 14 gallons of fuel per day per truck. A standard operator is 200 gallons a month or 2,400 gallons annually. Low-rolling resistant tires are guaranteed by the USAPA SmartWay program to increase fuel mileage by 4%. With our monitoring systems, we're seeing close to 6% on our trucks. An APU and low-rolling resistance tires packaged together saves over 3,000 gallons of fuel annually, savings to the operator of about $9,000 a year. Return on investment is 1.7 years. On a five-year low-cost loan, it improves the operator's bottom line by $4,950 after payments. The companies that make these investments are reaping an economic benefit in either sustaining operations or growing during an economic downturn. We have case studies from Sharon Banks, who is our CEO, that parallel testimony to the Highway and Transit Subcommittee at the U.S. House of Representatives on January 27, 2009. Alex Kreider, he drives for Stinger Transport in Prineville, Oregon. His 1998 International has logged over 1.5 million miles. Alex supports his wife and young children with his truck, so profitability is vital. CSS helped Alex finance low-rolling resistance tires, lightweight rims, and APUs. His quote to Congress is, "I saved over $700 a month." With an APU, Alex does not have to idle his main engine at night for appliances. He's able to eat healthier because his wife prepares and freezes food, which he keeps in his freezer and microwaves while out on the road. Edward Haynes and Sonia Jesty from Kaiser, Oregon, deliver flowers and frozen foods from Florida. Making sound investment in SmartWay equipment, have grown their business from one truck in 2006 to four trucks by 2008. Mesilla Valley Transport, our largest fleet, now achieves 7.7 miles per gallon as a fleet average. Using SmartWay specifications with APUs, aerodynamics, low-rolling resistance tires, wheels, and speed limiters. This is significantly better than the national average of 5.8 miles per gallon. In 2006, MVT was a fleet of 900 and has grown to 1,100 in 2008. Another example that I put in here, but we didn't include to our congressional testimony, Cross Creek Transport out of Central Point, Oregon. We got involved in May of 2008, provided APU financing for 70 vehicles. In November 2008, Scott Feller, the Cross Creek General Manager, quoted, "We have saved over $1 million in fuel savings in 6 months." Cross Creek employs 100 people, and although economic times are tough, they're staying in business and have had no layoffs. It makes good economic sense to do this, and I encourage the committee to really consider that when they look at 2186. Between Sharon, John, and myself, our CEO and Vice President, myself, we've got 75 years of military service in this country, and we feel it's a national priority to reduce our dependence upon foreign oil and clean up our air.
Thank you, Mr. Harris, for your service and for your testimony.
Thank you.
First, I'd like to thank Mr. Chairman and the rest of the committee members. My name is Jeff Kim. I'm with Shore Power Technologies. I'm also a member of the Oregon Electric Vehicle Association. In general, both entities support low-carbon fuels. More specifically, we support cost-effective fuels that both reduce petroleum use, criteria emissions, and greenhouse gases. And I kind of like to emphasize that point of cost effectiveness. And at least most of the technologies I'm going to talk about today do have the potential to save money rather than cost money. So that's an important point. Some of the other points I was going to bring up, made my job easier. The previous testimony has made my job easier, so I won't waste the time by repeating a lot of that. Engine idling has been brought up. That's one area that we specialize in, and that's the plug-in technologies or shore power. It's referred to often. Shore power, the term in general, comes from the marina market where boats pull up to shore and plug in. So this is not a old technology or a complicated technology. It just makes sense. When you're not trying to move the vehicle, you plug in and use a cleaner source of fuel. The other items I'd like to talk about are basic electric vehicles and electric vehicle charging. Chris Bakken put it very well and stated there's a lot of opportunities in this area. Currently, there's very few options that a consumer can go out and actually purchase an electric vehicle or plug-in hybrid. However, many companies, pretty much every major manufacturer, including GM, Toyota, Nissan, you name it, they're coming out with some form of plug-in technology. And to attract those manufacturers and ensuring that the technologies are available, we also have to do our part to make sure the infrastructure to plug in is available. And again, that represents not only emission savings and reduced carbon emissions, but also jobs, helping the economy out. And switching back a little to the point of idle reduction, a couple times we spoke about both infrastructure or what's called truck stop electrification, as well as APUs or generators. And one point we'd like to point out is that those are actually compatible in a lot of cases. There's APUs or auxiliary power units that are made that can be plugged in when there is a plug available. So if there's a plug available, you don't have to run that engine. And when there's not, you're still getting a benefit over running a 15-liter engine to get heat and air conditioning. So either way, there's a benefit, but we'd like to promote the use of plug-in capable APUs. Nissan, Toyota, and other manufacturers have been in discussions with the state on some level to bring new plug-in vehicles to the state. And they'd like to actually launch or have the state of Oregon and potentially other areas be the first areas that they deploy these vehicles. And again, I'd just like to emphasize that Oregon, with your leadership, will benefit the people that if we're part of that process. One manufacturer in particular, just to give you an idea of scale, has stated there'll be a requirement for over 500,000 plug-in or charging stations, and that's over the next 5 years. So you can put a price tag on that and determine that's just one manufacturer, and the economic benefit coming from or coming to the state if we produce those here is quite big.
Great.
That's about it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your testimony, and to all three of you for coming to the Capitol today. Welcome, and hope it's not the last time that we see you. So thanks for being here. Are there any questions for this panel? You have a question? No? Good. Super.
Good job.
Great. Thanks for being here. We're going to go on, and a couple of other folks who I know have made a special effort to be here today, Tim Miller and Brad Hippert, if you could please... Go ahead when you're ready.
All right. Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. I'm going to echo a little bit of what you heard.
You could identify yourself for the record.
Yes, okay. Yes. Thanks. My name is Tim Miller, and I'm the president and CEO of a startup vehicle company called Greenlight Motors based here in Oregon. We have prototyped a breakthrough commuter vehicle that goes 100 miles per gallon. It's a unique, fully enclosed, three-wheeled vehicle that combines the benefits and the safety and comfort of a car along with the fun and convenience of a motorcycle. And our plug-in hybrid design provides 250 miles of range and comfortable freeway cruising, just to give you a feel for what we're working on. I'd like to make three quick points in support of this bill. First, we can make tremendous strides in reducing the carbon intensity of our fuels for transportation. Despite relatively cheap gas today, the sting of $4 gas last summer permanently convinced consumers they will face ever-rising fuel costs in the future. Vehicle manufacturers have also woken up to this reality, with every major manufacturer announcing programs from hybrids to plug-in hybrids to electric vehicles slated to hit the market in 2010 or 2011. And right here in Oregon, we have several vehicle startups aiming to address this demand, from Greenlight Motors to Brammo to Porteon to Buggy and others. So the demand is there, and the vehicles will be there to support low-carbon fuels. Second, jobs. Encouraging more efficient vehicles will create green-collar jobs in many sectors. Our own plans include creating hundreds of green manufacturing jobs over the next 5 years, with even more job growth among our local suppliers. When investors ask me why we are planning to manufacture here in Oregon, I explain that Oregon's supportive green policies and our green consumer ethos makes this the perfect incubator market for a young company. Beyond manufacturing jobs, a push for lower carbon vehicles will also create infrastructure jobs, we just heard about, to support the electrification of Oregon's vehicle fleet, along with vehicle service jobs and utility and technology jobs to enable vehicle-to-grid solutions. Oregon's leadership here will put us at the forefront of a whole array of jobs and exportable skills, just as our leadership in the green building arena has done. Third, consistency across states matters. Taking Greenlight Motors as one example, I can tell you we are looking at marketing our products up and down the West Coast and eventually across the country. Having Oregon coordinate with other states in crafting these measures and then defining the leading measures will make it easier for manufacturers to bring these benefits to Oregon consumers. Finally, a cautionary note. While reducing the carbon intensity of our vehicles, I would strongly caution everyone working on these policies to be careful about the definition of the word vehicle. The vehicle solutions of the future will not look like our father's Oldsmobiles, four wheels and 4,000 pounds. There will be two-wheeled and three-wheeled and other solutions as we innovate to provide safe, efficient mobility. And vehicle policies need to be crafted that encourage that full range of innovation. So with smart vehicle policies, we can dramatically reduce carbon intensity of Oregon's vehicles while creating a broad array of jobs, and we can do it in a way that coordinates with other states to create large markets. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Go ahead.
Thank you, Committee Chair and committee members, for giving us the opportunity to testify here today. I believe that we need a public policy which will move our economy from one that is fossil fuel based to one that uses alternative energy. One of the best examples is the use of electricity to run vehicles. This solution could significantly lower...
Sorry, I'm going to interrupt you and ask. I'm not sure if you identified yourself for the record, so would you do that, please?
Excuse me. Brad Hippert with Portion Electric Vehicles, President. Thank you.
Thank you.
This solution could significantly lower our greenhouse gases as well as reduce our dependence on foreign oil. So I'm here today to try and demystify electric vehicles for you and how they can be a real-world solution to our transportation woes, as well as providing a solution to offset carbon emissions. As president of Portion Vehicles, I've been involved with electric vehicles for close to 10 years, initially as a hobbyist and for the last 4 years as a profession. Since then, I have witnessed firsthand the breakthrough in electric vehicle technology and its ability to reduce carbon emissions. And when you think about it, so have you. A vehicle that specifically comes to mind is the hybrid car. First introduced to this country in the year 2000, we must understand, though, exactly what this hybrid car is. If we simply state the obvious, it's an internal combustion engine combined with the same technology used in electric vehicles. This accomplishes two things. First, it increases the miles per gallon, thereby reducing carbon emissions, and second, it decreases pollution. So not only has this technology been well received and wildly successful, shortly we will witness the unveiling of the third generation of these hybrid vehicles, which will drop the retail price from $26,000 approximately to $20,000 and further increase the miles per gallon from 50 to 60 miles approximately, further reducing carbon emissions and pollution. So beyond the advances in hybrid vehicles with partial electric powertrains, full electric vehicles are emerging from many manufacturers in the near future. As president of Portion, I can state that as a company, we are well positioned to bring to market the next generation of medium-speed electric vehicles. These vehicles are 100% electric, travel at speeds up to 35 miles per hour, and will replace the second vehicle in many homes, especially for people who live in smaller cities like Ashland, Oregon, or well-designed smart cities like Portland. While we don't dispute the power density and applications of refined petroleum for their specific needs, we do assert that in the appropriate application, electric vehicles are far superior to internal combustion engines. Under a wheel-to-well analysis, not only does the combination of renewable energy to operate these vehicles result in zero pollution and zero carbon, but in addition, our cost-effective approach to mobility also provides utilities and developers with important synergies that further reduce our global footprint. They reduce the capital expenditures on infrastructure and electrical storage. And this means an additional reduction in carbon emissions. So, of course, Oregon has already made a strong commitment to do just that. And while this might seem somewhat far-reaching, I assure you it isn't. We fully support the Low Carbon Fuel Standard and invite you to visit us at your convenience to experience firsthand our technology, to ride and drive these vehicles, and learn how these technologies can work together to create real-world solutions. And I thank you again for your time.
And thank you, both for your innovation and leadership in this emerging field. Any questions for the panel? Yes, Representative Bailey.
If the chair will indulge, just a quick comment.
Yep.
I just wanted to thank you both, Mr. Hibbert, Mr. Miller. Both you and the panel before you represent a proud tradition of entrepreneurship here in Oregon, and I thank you for your commitment to building our economy as well as helping our environment.
Thank you for your support. Thanks.
Representative Boone.
Yeah, I hope I didn't miss this. I've been up since 2:30 this morning. But how long do they run? How far can you go?
The vehicles can be designed to meet the needs of the appropriate task at hand. So they can go 40 miles per charge, they can go 100 miles per charge, they can go 200 miles per charge, dependent upon the need of the end user. So we, rather than have a system that's overbuilt, we built specifically to the needs of the end user, whether it's a consumer, business application, etc.
Thanks. Yep. Representative Smith.
And we are just about out of time, but I'll try you, Mr. Miller. Thank you, Mr. Chair. How well is Oregon situated to be a global leader in these technologies? There are at least two or three people on this panel whose, you know, a portion of our life mission is to see if we can make our state sort of a Silicon Valley for, you know, new energy technology and new energy economy. How much pipey is that dream?
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I can say that in doing competitive analyses for where we are headed as Greenlight Motors, we look a lot at what other companies are doing. In sort of the alternative vehicle arena, I'd say Oregon is fairly well positioned by having a handful of players that are working on alternative vehicle solutions that are genuine, non-hobbyist, real companies, the ones that I mentioned. In California, there are certainly a handful of others, venture vehicles, the Aptera, and some others. So that's in the alternative vehicle space. But I think we have a chance of being a significant player as a state with our three or four players in that arena. Of course, you have to compare that again against then the global players out of Detroit and everywhere else who are working on solutions that will be more mass marketed. But I think we can enter into some of these niches with unique products that are tailored to, as Brad mentioned, specific applications in spaces where the big players will not play, and we'll be able to create hundreds of jobs. And down the road, maybe after those big companies acquire our companies, maybe they'll keep them here and keep the manufacturing growing here.
Thanks very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, great answer. Thanks very much. With that, I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2186. As I mentioned before, we will hear more testimony. There are quite a few other folks signed up to testify. We'll be posting on that. It may be next Tuesday. And we will close the House Committee on Energy or on Environment and Water.